Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about quite an interesting, quite an important, quite a useful book, really, titled Gray Areas: How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. As suggested by the title, the book does both investigation and recommendation, putting both of those together to help us understand the complicated, interconnected histories and realities of labor and race in the United States. I'm very pleased, therefore, to welcome the author of this book, Dr. Adia Harvey Wingfield, to the podcast. Adia, thank you so much for being here to tell us about your book.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I am a sociologist at Washington University in St. Louis, and most of my research focuses on racial and gender inequality in the professions. And historically, my work has looked at Black workers in particular in a lot of occupations, nursing, medicine, the law, engineering, to try to understand why Black workers are so underrepresented in those jobs and what their experiences are in those jobs. And what I wanted to do with Gray Areas was to take a bit more of an expansive focus and to talk a bit more about why overall we are in what strikes me as a bit of a paradox in the United States. We're at this place where we are over 60 years from the passing of the the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964, which explicitly outlaws racial discrimination. We have a society where the diversity industry is this multi-billion dollar industry. It makes an enormous amount of money. And we have workers who, by and large, say that they are interested in working for companies that have some commitment to diversity. But at the same time, we also live in a society where Black workers are likely to experience significant wage disparities that don't go away even with more education. They're significantly underrepresented in leadership in virtually every industry, and they are underrepresented in middle management and leadership jobs. And so to me, those things seem like a paradox, and I wanted to understand how both of those things can be true. And that's what led me to start thinking about and doing the work for Gray Areas to try to understand why we have such a seeming paradox when it comes to our workplaces, and to make the argument that I put forth in the book, which is that it's not that we are still dealing with explicit legal racial diversity. It is not that we lack a surplus of qualified Black workers. It's aspects of how we are working that are contributing to these inequalities and disparities.
Always interesting to know kind of what sorts of questions and confusions and puzzles bring people to research projects. And yeah, no, that one is definitely worth investigating. So thank you for giving us that introduction. Sticking kind of with, I suppose, big picture aspects, obviously the title, I think, deserves further discussion. What do you mean by gray areas? And what are the key organizational cultures that you investigate in the book?
Right. So when I talk about gray areas, as is referenced in the title, what I'm talking about are the key parts of work and the key parts of our jobs that are usually unspecified, unregulated, and a bit ambiguous and not clearly defined, because those are the areas that, as I said, allow racial inequality to persist and maintain. So, for example, my job is that I'm a college professor, and that means that if you look at my job contract, I'm required to do research, teaching, and service, sometimes a lot of service, but that's neither here nor there. But I do research, teaching, and service, and my contract specifies that that's what I'm responsible for. But my contract doesn't specify that if I want to make sure that I'm eligible for fellowships or awards or things like that, then I need to make sure that I'm maintaining the social parts of my job and maintaining relationships with colleagues that can nominate me for things or write me letters of recommendation. My contract doesn't specify that if I want to succeed in my job, I have to understand the organizational culture here at WashU and make sure that I'm essentially fitting into it and not doing things that are in violation that cause me to stand out in a negative way. And my contract doesn't specify that if I want to advance in my career, then I need to make sure that I forge connections with sponsors, with mentors, and people who can facilitate that advancement. Those things are never specified. specified for the most part in anybody's job. But those are the things, those are the gray areas, the unspecified, unregulated parts of our work that are social, cultural, and relational that have a lot to do with how we find jobs, how we succeed in jobs, and how we advance or don't advance in jobs. And those are the areas where, like I said, a lot of racial inequality gets maintained.
Okay, that's very helpful to understand so that we know exactly what we're looking at. I'd like to discuss kind of how we're looking at it. You have seven people that you focus on in the book in order to excavate what's going on in these gray areas. Can you briefly introduce us to the seven people and explain how and why you chose them?
Yes, sure. So the seven workers come from a range of different backgrounds and work in a range of industries. So there is Constance, who's a chemical engineer at a university. There is Kevin, who's a nonprofit worker at a nonprofit focused on reducing educational disparities. There's Alex, who is in the gig economy driving for Uber Eats. There's Max, an emergency medicine doctor. There's Brian, who is a film producer and more in the cultural line of work. There's Amalia, who's a journalist, and there's Darren, who's a financial executive. And so as you can see, those are people who are in very disparate fields. I think it's a safe enough wager that someone like Alex, who's the Uber Eats driver, doesn't really have a lot in common work-wise with someone like Darren, who's this very highly ranking, very highly successful financial executive. But the point of picking workers from those very different backgrounds and fields is to illustrate that gray areas are affecting workers in a variety of different settings. It's not just people who are doing professional jobs. It's not just people who are in lower wage gig work. There's this way that gray areas span our work in ways that contribute to these outcomes for Black workers. And I just realized I forgot to answer your earlier question about organizational culture, but that actually comes into play with the reason why I chose the workers that I did. When we think about organizational culture, I rely on the definition and the paradigms put forth by management scholars, who often refer to organizational culture as the unspoken, implicit culture that shapes the decisions, the norms, the values, and the everyday kind of lifeblood and aspects of an organization. But organizational cultures are going to vary a lot depending on which type of culture or which type of profession organization we're talking about. But management scholars have typically divided them into four typologies. There is the clan culture, which refers to organizational cultures that encourage people to see each other as members of a family and encourage a real close-knit culture where there's collective shared decision-making. There are adhocracy cultures, and I think of these as more in the mold of startups or early Silicon Valley businesses like Facebook in the early days, where the culture is that people should move fast and break things and be really innovative and take risks and color outside the lines. There are hierarchy-based cultures, which are organized around hierarchies and following established rules, especially when those rules dictate who in the hierarchy is supposed to be making decisions and following those. And then finally, there are market-based cultures, which focus primarily on making sure that the company is organized around creating products and orienting themselves towards market-based outcomes. And so the seven workers that I cover in gray areas come from at least one of those cultural backgrounds. Some of them, like Kevin, have experience in hierarchy cultures and more clan cultures. Some of them are primarily focused only in one culture, like Darren, the financial executive, whose work has always been in market-based cultures. And then there are workers like Alex, the gig economy worker, for whom the organizational culture doesn't seem to touch her directly, but there's still an impact on the type of work that she does. And so the idea, again, is that by including such a range of Black workers in different fields, in different organizational cultures, and in different environments, we get a sense that the wide variety of ways the gray areas are having an impact on workers today and how they're able to maintain this work environment where, again, we see so little racial diversity, despite ostensibly being committed to that as a society.
Okay, that's very helpful, I think, to map out the workers and the different cultures. So thank you for giving us that foundation that allows us then to discuss that in more detail. So I suppose one thing I'd like to ask you about first is, in many ways, these different workplace cultures seem quite opposite in some senses, right? If we're thinking about like a market-driven culture versus a clan-based culture or a feminized culture and a masculinized culture, these seem kind of very different as workplace environments and therefore would perhaps seem like they would create different kinds of problems for workers. But you talk about in the book, there's actually some really interesting ways that if we look at, say, feminized clan-based work cultures and masculinized market-driven work cultures, they actually might be creating pretty similar challenges for Black workers. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, sure. And so that was kind of what I was alluding to before when I looked at Kevin, one of the people that I talked to in the book. And so Kevin had this experience where he had been employed at this financial institution in finance for a while. And he just really did not like that job. He felt that it was very antiseptic and sterile. And he just wasn't very motivated by the idea of trying to make more money for people who already had a lot of money. And he also characterized that workplace, as you described it, as a very male-dominated culture, a very market-based culture. And that is consistent with a lot of what we know about organizational culture in the financial industry. It is an industry where it is disproportionately male-dominated, particularly at the higher ranks. It obviously is very market-based because it's organized around market outcomes and market returns. And so what Kevin found in that space was that it seemed very alienating to him, and it didn't seem like a place that aligned with some of the core inner values that he had. And so what Kevin decided to do was to leave the financial sector and to move into the educational space. And so that was when he joined the nonprofit. And this is also where he was in for kind of a rude awakening, because he expected the nonprofit space to be one as a more feminized culture, where he anticipated, rightly or wrongly, more collaboration, more involvement in decision making, more of a focus on the goals of the nonprofit, which were to reduce educational disparities. And because it was a more feminized culture, and because it was a clan-based culture, he thought that there would really be opportunities for him to be a part of that space and to offer input, particularly as pertained to families of color, which was part of the nonprofit association's goal to reduce those educational disparities writ large, but for families of color in particular. And so what Kevin found when he got into that space, though, was that a lot of the dynamics that made the financial sector off-putting for him, the coldness, the unwillingness to address and deal with racial issues, the ways in which he often was marginalized and told explicitly or implicitly that his voice was not welcome, a lot of those dynamics really repeated themselves in the more feminized clan-based culture. He found that upon moving into that space, leaders often marginalized him. When he tried to speak up in ways that were consistent with the organization's mission about reducing disparities and encouraging people to consider ways that families of color were treated through the nonprofit, he felt that he often was silenced, that people didn't listen to or want to take into consideration the points that he was making. Again, even though they were consistent with the stated aspects of the mission, those statement aspects did not include things that Kevin tried to bring to his colleagues' attention. So even though we see him operating in two, I think, very different spaces on the surface, I don't think most of us would suggest or believe that a financial industry or a financial company or a bank seems very similar to an educational nonprofit. They have wildly different budgets, very different cultures, very different compositions of workers. For a Black male worker like Kevin, the consistencies were still present around the ways that both organizational spaces had cultures that silenced and marginalized issues related to race, and often silenced and marginalized him as a Black man worker trying to identify ways that those issues could be resolved.
Do you mind if I ask a bit of a follow-up on that point?
Yeah, sure.
Could you tell us a bit more about how that silencing is happening in both of those environments?
Yeah. So for Kevin, it often happened in meetings in public spaces. So often when he was in the nonprofit space, there were staff meetings where he would attempt to try to say, you know, we've been talking about this issue that we're having with this particular family, if they're a family of color. You know, maybe one of the things that we could do is not mistreat this. Like, if this family is coming to the school and they have concerns about their kid, we could actually listen to what they have to say. We could not bar them from the building. You know, we could give them a chance to talk openly, and we could try to treat them respectfully in the way that we treat other families when they bring concerns about their children. And for Kevin, he often found that when he would make those types of suggestions, again, things that were pertinent to the organization's mission of reducing educational disparities around families of color, people sometimes talked over him, or there were awkward silences, and then they moved on to other business. His comments didn't really generate the interaction and discussion that he expected to have happen when he would bring those things up. When he would try to interact with supervisors and leaders in the organization, the interactions that he had were often very chilling and very distant. So the ways in which he tried to raise these issues often was met in both settings with people making it clear that that type of commentary was not welcome, encouraged, or appreciated. And similar dynamics happened in the financial setting. In those cases, he wasn't talking about reducing racial disparities per se, but he might raise questions about how the bank might want to invest in broader areas and might want to consider communities of color that they had previously been overlooking, or ways to reach communities of color in their outreach. And again, it became pretty clear from the non-response that he got from colleagues in meetings and from supervisors in those spaces that that wasn't the type of thing that they were interested in discussing, much less pursuing.
Got it. No, that's helpful to have added on. So thank you for that.
Sure.
That obviously is about kind of similarities that we may not expect across organizational cultures. In a similar vein, I wonder if you can talk perhaps about maybe to some extent similarities across sectors. One aspect of the book is you talk about hierarchical cultures and the extent to which maybe they can avoid some of these problems. Maybe. Can we talk a bit about kind of how that works, or the extent to which that works in different sectors? You do a great comparison in the book between hospitals and journalism, which seem very different from each other and therefore quite useful to illustrate this point.
Yeah, so that is an interesting example to consider as well, because I think we may look from the outside as lay people, right, at people who are Black workers in particular who are in higher up leadership roles in organizations and think, you know, what could they possibly have to complain about? This person is in this high ranking role. They're the VP of whatever. I mean, clearly everything's got to be good for them, right? But what I learned from particularly talking to people like Max and Amalia, who are the doctor and the journalist respectively that I interviewed, who were employed in these hierarchy cultures, was that simply being in a leadership role in a company that valued hierarchy wasn't necessarily sufficient in erasing some of the racial issues that they encountered. Now, it could certainly help, right? Because you take someone like Max, who is this emergency medicine doctor. By any measure, he's had a great deal of career success. I mean, doctors have an enormous amount of status and prestige in American culture and in many places around the world. He was in a position where basically he was the end of the line when it came to decision making in the emergency medical in the emergency medicine department. Doctors have more status than nurses, than technicians, than a lot of the people who are around them. And so he was at the top. He was making the decisions. He was the doctor. He's the go-to person, right? So on the face of it, that certainly puts Max in a position where he can most of the time make decisions, can give orders and expect those orders to be followed, can expect that he has some authority that comes from the position associated with his role in the hierarchy. But interestingly, what I found with Max was that there were a lot of cases where that authority was undermined in ways that the organization didn't do much about. So for Max, it did not necessarily come from colleagues. It often came from patients. And I mentioned that Max is a patient in an emergency medicine department, and that's key to point out. Because what Max found was that a lot of the time when he was treating, no, I shouldn't say a lot of the time, but there certainly were cases that were not infrequent. When he was treating patients who would come to the emergency room and they would say, you know, I'm going to sue you if you don't get me a white doctor. There's got to be a white doctor on staff. I'm not going to let you treat me. You obviously, you know, I can't trust that you know what you're talking about. And again, making it pretty clear by requesting a white doctor specifically that they weren't having doubts because of his background or his qualifications, the doubts were because of his racial status. And so what's interesting about that is that working in this hierarchy culture means that Max is imbued with the authority to make decisions, to provide healthcare, to make the final sign-off, but he still is in a position where that authority isn't universally respected by people in the chain of command, so to speak, or in the organizational space. Now, Max was fortunate because he also worked in an environment where the people around him knew what he did and they knew that he was good at his job. And so when people filed complaints, when patients filed complaints about his performance based on things that either didn't happen or that were not grounded in reality, or things that confused. So he had one case, for example, where he was confused with another Black doctor who was working a different shift. And so a patient filed a complaint. It was clear it could not have been a complaint against Max. He wasn't even working that night. There's just no way that what the patient alleged could have been attributed to him. When things like that happened, his supervisor kind of understood that those things were often driven by racial bias, and he discarded them. The supervisor discarded them, threw them out, didn't take them seriously, whatever. But the point that I make in the book is that with a hierarchy culture in place, in a colorblind culture that is also consistent of how this organizational culture works, Max is really kind of at the mercy of his colleagues. If he has colleagues who don't stick up for him, who don't support him, who don't encourage dismissing complaints that are baseless, there's really no recourse for him, because the organizational culture as a colorblind one doesn't take into consideration how even Black doctors with authority may find that authority undermined. And I think that is one of the points we want to take into consideration when we think about the limits of hierarchy culture, that it does not necessarily imbue or protect Black workers in that hierarchy completely from the types of issues that they can face. And there's a similar paradigm present with Amalia, the journalist, who is in an organization where the hierarchy offers some protection from the types of emotional and racist abuse that she encounters as a Black woman journalist. But again, that hierarchy and that protection has limits. It's very broadly designed to protect journalists writ large. It's not taken into consideration to focus on the specific types of racist and sexist abuse that's being launched at someone like Amalia for, again, doing her job, for creating pieces that focus on aspects of race and inequality in the U.S. and in American life. This is what she has been hired to do, but she's hired into a job that comes with certain consequences that the company's hierarchical culture doesn't necessarily take into consideration and therefore cannot address.
Okay, that's very useful to understand kind of the benefits and also really the limits of this kind of culture. If we then go to the exact opposite, or what we might think is the exact opposite of something super hierarchical like a hospital, is the gig economy any better? Does it offer more opportunity for avoiding these kinds of gray areas?
So that is a great question, and one that I really tried to dig into in the book, because I was really curious about that too. And I think on some level, and I want to say this very, very, very cautiously, because I don't want to give the impression that I think the gig economy is a panacea from these issues. But when I talked with Alex, the gig worker, there were some ways that her experiences were very different from the other workers that I interviewed. And so when I asked her specifically if she felt that she'd ever encountered racial or gender discrimination in her work, she told me that she hadn't. And that's very atypical for Black workers, particularly Black workers in the service industry, where they often do encounter these types of disparities. But when she told me a little bit more about her work, it made sense why she had this reaction. Because essentially, I mean, if we all have used some kind of platform-based work at this point, probably. Alex at the time was driving for Uber Eats. It's very straightforward. You pick up food, you deliver it, you drop it off, and that's pretty much the end of the story, right? So when I asked her about racial and gender discrimination, she was kind of like, no, that's not really a thing in the work that I'm doing. There's no opportunity for it. You know, I just get the food and I drop it off. So with Alex's work, there is not an opportunity for her to have to interact with coworkers or to see differences in how colleagues might be treated. There's not a boss. There's not a supervisor. If you were doing this type of gig work, technically you're not even an employee. You're a contractor, right? So you don't have a boss or a supervisor or colleagues. It's very autonomous, independent work. And I think when we look at autonomous, independent work like that, to some degree, there are a lot of benefits for Black workers in the sense that they are not surrounded by colleagues like the ones that, say, Kevin described, where he's constantly being ignored and silenced and dismissed in his meetings. That type of thing doesn't happen to Alex because there are no meetings and there are no colleagues. But before we, you know, get too far along in the gig economy as a kind of a savior of these types of issues, I think there are still kind of warnings to consider and things to keep in mind. One is that by virtue of the fact that Alex has no colleagues, she's not aware of ways that she may be treated differently. But it also bears repeating that because Alex has no colleagues, she's not aware of ways that she may be treated differently, right? There's no way to know if she's getting lower tips than people who are doing the same work. There's no way for her to know or acknowledge whether there are biases in how Uber Eats algorithms are set up, meaning that certain areas may be excluded from delivery options while other neighborhoods aren't. And when I looked a little bit more closely into the gig industry, I found that, gig work, and platform-based work, I found that a lot of inequality actually is digitized into these platforms in terms of ways in which rates are differently set for different workers or for different users, ways in which different neighborhoods and parts of various cities have access to platform-based work and some that don't. For example, researchers at the University of Chicago here in the United States found that Uber riders whose names seem to signal that they are Black men are often subjected to higher fare rates than those whose names do not signal that they are Black men. For Airbnb listings, those that are listed in neighborhoods that are predominantly Black or more comprised of people of color often receive lower listing prices than those that are not. So there still is inequality that's digitized, that's baked into these platforms. The gig economy hasn't erased that inequality. It's made it a lot more digital, but it hasn't gotten rid of it. And so while I think that for workers like Alex, this type of platform work and this type of contract work does offer some ways to sidestep some of the areas that other areas that I talk about in the book. It doesn't require the networks that are necessary to get hired. It doesn't put you in a position where you have these colleagues who may be a problem for you, but it also still replicates broader systemic inequalities. And it doesn't necessarily put workers in a position where they are aware of how those inequalities may be affecting them.
Okay, so that's a useful sort of somewhat, but not entirely, to be aware of so that we don't kind of accidentally create utopias where they don't exist. And in fact, you mentioned something I'd love to ask about, because of course, this whole discussion about gray areas in the workplace is not just about when you're in the job, it's also about getting that job. And so you just mentioned networks. I wonder if you can tell us more about the ways in which networks did or did not operate for the seven people you focus on in the book, and what you think some of the key reasons are for the fact that it's really quite a different story depending on the type of work that they're doing.
Yeah, so this is the key thing that I really wanted to focus on in the book, because we know researchers who study this type of stuff know that networks and connections matter so much in getting access to jobs. They are critical. I think at this point, upwards of 70% of people who are hired because they have some sort of connection to someone at the job in which they're working. These networks matter enormously and significantly. Now, what we also know, though, in terms of ways that this can backfire, is that when we think about hiring people through our networks, our networks, again, at least in the U.S., are also very racially homogenous. So there's a study from the Public Religion Research Institute that shows that for white individuals who were part of that survey, upwards of about 75% of them had no people of color at all in their close friend networks. So when we require or when we have a workplace system that rests on people getting jobs and getting hired through their connections, often what we are reproducing are people who already are in networked with other white colleagues who find access to jobs because of those existing networks. So we end up with a tiered and hierarchical system where basically, to put it kind of bluntly, and my colleagues like Deirdre Royster have found this to be true, David Padula has found this to be true, that white workers often find jobs for other white workers. This doesn't become a way in which a multiplicity of people have access to jobs. Workers of color are often shut out from these networks. They are not referred, and when they are referred, they are less likely to be able to take those referrals as far as their white counterparts. So what this looks like in the book takes a number of different forms. There's someone like Constance, for example, the chemical engineer that I mentioned, who is a researcher and a college professor, who was very open about how the networks that she had coming out of grad school made it entirely possible for her to land in her job as a college professor. But those networks also meant that she ended up in a situation where she kind of inadvertently changed disciplinary area upon being hired, and then had to rebuild networks all on her own as a result of doing that. And that became enormously challenging as a Black woman in this white male dominated field, where she found that her efforts to create these networks and to form these ties with colleagues were often rebuffed. They were met with closed doors. They were met with blank stares. It's just been this uphill battle for her of trying to form these networks. And it has had career implications for her in terms of not getting nominated for awards or proposals, in terms of delaying her promotion process, in terms of challenging her opportunities and her abilities to move into leadership roles. All those things have been affected by her not being kind of connected to the right people in her field. So that's one example that I think is really useful. And even people like Alex, who I mentioned before, as the Uber Eats driver, that presents a contrast in the sense that this type of platform work doesn't necessarily require people to have networks in order to do platform work, right? Anybody with a smartphone can download Uber Eats and sign up to be a driver or whatever and get to work. But we also have to think about how the types of jobs that don't require access to networks are not necessarily jobs that require a lot of long-term economic stability. And that is very much the case for these types of platform-based jobs. They're not intended to do that. They're not intended to be jobs that offer kind of long-term rely only on those job support. And that's not what Alex was using hers for. It was a stopgap until she was able to find better employment. So we live in a society where very much who you know matters enormously. It connects people to jobs. It makes it possible to thrive in certain jobs. But because our networks are often so racially structured, forming those networks can become very difficult for Black workers, and it can have long-term career consequences.
Very important to understand, especially given the research mentioned there about kind of who's in whose networks. So thank you for adding that piece in. You mentioned leadership positions, though, in that answer, and I'd love to talk about that more. Can you tell us about some of the challenges for Black workers in terms of achieving leadership positions and what kind of we can learn from the people who have managed to do that and understand sort of the reasons why it's so few?
Yeah, great question. So I spent a lot of time, as you know, in the book also focusing on this question of leadership, because that was part of what motivated me to start thinking about this in the first place, just seeing these gaps and disparities in leadership. When we look at a broad survey of industries in the United States, Black workers are underrepresented in leadership in virtually all of them, whether we are talking about finance, politics, certainly corporate spaces, technology. I'm an academic and my own industry is certainly not exempt from this. So this is clearly, again, something that's a systemic pattern that I think as a social scientist, I wanted to understand better and to try to make more sense of. And interestingly, what we find is that there's no shortage of Black workers who are very interested in and striving for leadership roles. In fact, data from the Coakwell, from a research group here in 2019, found that Black women were actually the group most likely, more so than white women, to express an interest in leadership positions, to believe in their own skills and capabilities in achieving those types of positions, and to want to forge the opportunities to move into those positions. But what we find is that mobility into leadership roles is often very heavily contingent on relationships with supervisors and managers. And in many cases, Black workers are the group most likely to report a distance from those same supervisors and managers that can facilitate their moves into leadership. And certainly that is what I found across industry after industry and worker after worker in this interview. So I'll tell you a story here about Brian, who I haven't mentioned so far. Brian is the film producer. And he was hired into a corporate role in a production company in the wake of some outcry here in the United States after the Academy Awards went several years without nominating any people of color for the top positions in the awards ceremonies for the Oscars. So there were 2 years where in the Best Actor and Best Actress category, only white actors were nominated. That led to a protest, which was called Oscars So White. And the company that hired Brian did so because they wanted to try to address this and incorporate more diversity. They wanted to bring in more voices and to try to produce a different slate of films. So Brian was hired to do exactly this. He found, though, that upon getting hired to do that job, it was not quite as easy as he thought. His supervisors were really reluctant to greenlight the projects that he was bringing forth. They sometimes wouldn't see the movies by previous directors that he was recommending and would just kind of shut them down without digging into the research or doing comparative analyses or what have you. So Brian found that he was in this role. There was a track to leadership. He could not get feedback about what he needed to do other than that supervisors would say that he needed improvement. When he would ask how he could improve or what type of areas he needed to improve in, he didn't get answers. He just got kind of vague feedback that wasn't clear. He was doing what he was hired to do and trying to do the job that he was expected, but kept getting stonewalled and non-answers. So eventually, Brian ended up leaving. He left and importantly took a position with someone else that he knew that was working at a film company that happened to be headed by another Black producer. And he felt a lot more confident in taking this step, that this would be an opportunity that would allow him to exercise his talents and to do the filmmaking work that he really loved and that he felt passionately about. And I bring up Brian's story because it's useful for illustrating how this distance from supervisors and from people in leadership can really adversely impact Black workers. Because again, Brian certainly felt that was the case in his own career, but it really inhibits companies as well when there are not channels built into place for facilitating those types of relationships. Because as we see in Brian's case, it can create turnover, right? I mean, it's a much better model for companies to be able to build in and invest in workers who have institutional knowledge, who can stay over the long term, who can produce, who can contribute to the organization's output. But when companies are allowing this distance between Black workers and people in leadership, they are contributing to potential turnover and people potentially leaving in ways that I think are not necessarily beneficial for companies that are trying to invest in and inculcate talent. And that's what we see happen in Brian's case, and that happened in the case of other respondents that I interviewed too.
Okay, so that seems like something that clearly senior managers, executives would want to avoid. What are the key things that someone in those sorts of positions could do in that instance, but kind of drawing from the book more broadly?
Yes, and this is one of my favorite questions because this does allow me to talk about solutions. We have a tendency in sociology to be very bleak and to talk about how everything is terrible, everything is systemic, but there are some solutions. And research has identified some things that leaders and companies can do to try to address the types of issues that I've been talking about. And in Brian's case, there's one semi-obvious one that I think many companies don't necessarily put into place in a way that works, right? Part of Brian's issue was that there was this distance between him and leaders, and he couldn't figure out how to bridge it. And so he ended up just leaving the company in frustration. One of the things that we know works from this research, though, that companies can do is to implement mentoring or sponsorship programs that are available to everybody. And this seems somewhat intuitive and very straightforward. But in many cases, there are a lot of companies where if there are mentoring programs put into place, they usually are ones where HR will select people they consider to be high performers, and they'll match those high performers with people who are in leadership roles in the organization. The problem with that is that people who are high performers are probably the people who are the least likely to need a formalized mentoring program. They likely already have a mentor in the program, in the office already, or they're already performing in such a way that they understand the kind of the ins and outs of the company and the things that are unspoken, the organizational culture, and the things that they need to do in order to thrive. When mentoring programs are open to everyone, though, when anyone who wants a mentor can sign up to have a mentor, and there's someone coordinating the program and making sure that people are matched together, then we know that what happens is that Black workers are more likely to sign up for these types of programs, and they are likely to see benefits in terms of the fact that they have someone who's explicitly responsible for making sure that they understand the ins and the outs of the culture and who's responsible for kind of shepherding through their success. And it also, I think, helps to address some of the challenges that may come from the mentor side as well, particularly as our workplaces are not very racially diverse, especially at the top ranks. When people are mentors who are white and they are tasked with mentoring Black workers, it can give them the opportunity to connect with people that they otherwise might not necessarily choose to on their own, but it can also give them a sense to see very closely what types of experiences and skills and talents and challenges that those workers are facing that might not otherwise be immediately evident. And so the data has shown that that really matters. Having those closer relationships and forging those connections across levels of the organization can really be very beneficial to Black workers in these spaces. And so I'll just bring up Darren's case as an example. Darren, who I also hadn't mentioned already, is the financial executive. And so when I asked him about his own trajectory in the industry and how he had made it to this leadership role and how he had had so much success over the course of his career, one of the things that he cited was that he had benefited enormously from having mentors and formal mentoring programs over the course of his career. He was matched with people early on who kind of took him under their wing and said, you know, here's what we need to make sure we're doing now. Oh, the company is getting bought. We need to make sure that we have retention agreements so that we're covered. And, you know, these were things that Darren certainly didn't know about and wasn't familiar with, but he was able to learn from everyone who was a mentor to him and to accumulate that knowledge through these formal programs in ways that really benefited his career climb. So that's an example of the type of strategy that really is very beneficial, that companies can implement relatively easily, and that really has a lot of, if you'll forgive the corporate metaphor, has a lot of bang for the buck.
Yeah, I mean, that it's not like you're saying something bizarre in Mars speak. Like, we've heard of these things. These are things that can be done.
Right.
So I am glad that we get to talk about solutions. And I think it's also key that you mentioned HR directors in there as well. That's such an aspect of this too. But what about people who aren't necessarily in charge of things? What can, for example, colleagues of Black workers do who aren't HR directors, who aren't senior leaders? What can colleagues do?
Sure. And I think there's room for everybody to think about how we can work to address the gray areas in our workplaces. When it comes to colleagues, there are three things that I would suggest that correspond to the areas of the book. When it comes to hiring, I suggest that colleagues who want to be allies can really make it a point to think about and reference a wide variety of workers for potential jobs. They can make it a point to make sure that their networks are inclusive of Black workers and that they can suggest Black workers for positions that might be open at their companies, given how much we know that social networks matter in terms of hiring. When it comes to organizational culture and navigating these spaces that can be colorblind, it makes such a difference when there are colleagues who are willing to speak out in support of why diversity in workplaces matters and who are willing to speak out, especially when people suggest otherwise. So having someone in the room who can say, you know, yes, I think I want to be on board with the initiatives that the company is doing. I think it's important that we try to navigate this. Or even when people see small scale things happening in meetings, like when I talked about Kevin being ignored or silenced or people interrupting him, to say, you know, I want to hear the rest of what Kevin has to say. Can you go back and finish your thought? Or can we talk more about what Kevin is bringing up? This is important to our mission. Taking steps like that can really help to change the culture in ways for Black workers that can be really valuable and to shift what the experience feels like on the ground. And then when it comes to advancement, again, it's just so important to state, and I think it's hard to overstate how important mentoring is. If you're a person who's in a regular position in a company, it's important to be able to suggest that people form relationships and that people form connections and that mentoring programs get into place and that you can serve as a mentor yourself to someone who's in a different position in the company than you. Because again, being able to do that is how people learn more about how companies operate. They learn more about the organizational culture. They learn more about what sociologists refer to as kind of the informal curriculum or the hidden curriculum, the aspects of work that are not as openly discussed as the baseline parts of how we do our jobs. And knowing more about those aspects can really be very beneficial for Black workers who otherwise often are frequently excluded or marginalized or shut out of this knowledge and information.
Okay, very practical things. I like that the book, as I said right at the beginning, it's problems and solutions.
Yes.
So thank you for taking us through things that really, I think many people can do. Obviously, this is something you have been working on rather a lot to come up with this book. So much work clearly went into it. Now that it's done, though, is there anything you might have on your horizon next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this topic, that you'd like to preview or highlight?
Yeah, I guess the main things that I've been working on, since we're still in this area of thinking about racial inequality at work, I'm looking now at a project that focuses on actually millennial workers and the extent to which corporate diversity policies have an impact on their employment decisions. Does that make them more or less likely to want to take a job? So that work has been funded by the National Science Foundation. And so we're digging through the data now and trying to put together some research papers to come out of that. But other than that, I've primarily been doing a lot of disciplinary work in my field. I'm actually the incoming president of the American Sociological Association, and we have our big conference next year. So planning that is going to take up an enormous amount of time, but it's an exciting opportunity to think about ways to highlight the importance that sociology has, particularly in times like now that are seeing a lot of social change happen, that are seeing a lot of social dissensions, a lot of dissension happen, and where social problems continue to be just as relevant as they always have been. Sociology is really important, I think, for thinking about what we're seeing and how to address it and how to think about and understand all the things happening in our world. And so I'm excited to see our professional association focus on some of those and elevate the work that our members are doing.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Exciting. And I'm sure there's so many cool things and also rather a lot of work.
Yes, that.
Yeah, no, I bet. So best of luck with all of that. I'm sure the conference will be fabulous. And of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing while you're working on it. Again, yes. Titled Gray Areas, How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. Adia, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This was such a fun discussion.